call the meeting back to order. Everyone would take their seats. Okay, we've got some scientists here to talk with us. Oh, boy. We always loved hearing from the scientists. Okay, the next item, number 11, Puget Sound Watershed Characterization Project. This is a briefing. We have George Wilhair and Tim Quinn. So good to see you both.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Commission members, Director Anderson, and Deputy Director Storr. Very happy to be here. My name is Timothy Quinn, and I'm the Chief Scientist of the Habitat Program, and I'm here along with my colleague, George Wilhair, who is a Senior Research Scientist in the Science Division of the Habitat Program. And we want to talk to you a little bit about watershed characterization. We're delighted to talk to you about this. You'll find it's one of the more colorful slideshows you'll see. We also think it'll be interesting and informative. I also wanted to tell you that I'm feeling delighted because I feel like I'm slightly overdressed, which doesn't happen very often in my real life. So watershed characterization, informing landscape scale land use decisions by local governments. So the key points, excuse me. It's certainly not mine, Director. Excuse me? I'm only partially overdressed. That's right. I thought this part was hidden down below. So the key points we want to make today, I'm going to give sort of the overview. I'm going to try to put the watershed characterization in the context of what the Habitat Program does. And then George is going to go through some of the technical aspects and get as deep into the science as you want to go. So first of all, urbanization represents a major threat to fish and wildlife habitats. It is one of our main challenges as a Fish and Wildlife Agency to maintain the legacy of Washington State in the face of urbanization, and we happen to be a very successful state in terms of growth, so it's one of our continuing challenges. GMA and SMA, the Growth Management Act and the Shoreline Management Act, require local governments to protect habitat. So when they require local governments to protect habitat, we try to provide information that makes that doable. We engage as partners in land use planning under GMA and SMA, and what that means is we not only provide information that they can use, but we also try to provide real-time guidance from our biologists to their biologists on one-to-one. This is particularly important because as our tools get more sophisticated, as we consider ecosystem-based management approaches to conservation and restoration, it gets more technical. We need to spend more time having our customers and our partners understand what we're trying to do so that they can better do it. Watershed characterization is our latest product for local planning. It's obviously going to be one of the more sophisticated ones and ones that we'll try to dig into a little bit for your information. The outline goes something like this. I want to reacquaint you with the Habitat Program. I know that you've been receiving a lot of briefings from the Habitat Program. We're delighted to be here. Sometimes it's really hard to shoehorn us. We try to reach partnerships across the state in a variety of venues. We're trying to help build not only these partnerships, but an understanding of who we are as a partner to our constituents. It helps educate them. It helps them do a better job at meeting multiple resource goals when they're doing their work. Then I want to talk to you a little bit. I want to burrow down and get into a little bit of the priority habitats and species under which watershed characterization falls. Priority Habitats and Species is our flagship program that tries to deliver this information, tries to deliver technical expertise, and tries to build these partnerships with the different constituents. And then the what's new, and that's the part that George will walk you through. So this is a list of things that you may have heard parts of about what the Habitat Program does. If I were to characterize this in a single statement, I would say, if you are doing major land use planning, we can help you understand and meet your goals while doing good things for fish and wildlife. So that's our goal here. We don't have a lot of regulatory authority. We don't presume to have a lot of regulatory authority. What we're there is to help inform, be partners with, help people understand so that they can try to meet their own goals. Many of these people have values, the same values we do for fish and wildlife, and we're trying to facilitate that. The watershed characterization basically falls under these three yellow or highlighted goals, and these are under sort of growth, our work on growth management and the Shoreline Master Acts, and then on the science effort to provide best available science under GMA. As you can see, there's a lot of things we're not talking about today, but that you might have heard a little bit about. So we're an incredibly lucky state. We have an immense amount of natural resource heritage that's still prevalent today. We have a thriving economy. As George reminds us, if that arrow were pointed down, it would look a lot like Cleveland or Detroit. So this is a mixed blessing, because as we have a great thriving economy, we also have challenges with land use and growth. And these are projections based on OFM in 2004. And as far as we can understand, they've been pretty good projections about population growth in Washington State. So here's an effort to try to visualize what expected growth would look like in Washington State. And this was a simulation done by the Centers for the American West at the University of Colorado. And if you follow me through, I'll pace you through some time steps. So here's 1990, and notice particularly the yellow area, 2050. So you can see that we're headed for a fair amount of urbanization, and as the urbanization grows, the connections between urban areas grows as well, so that the threat probably in the worst case scenario is something that looks like the Los Angeles Valley, or that central valley of Los Angeles, where because we're growing in city centers, that eventually these things come and connect. So this is one of our great challenges. So what I wanted to point out here is I wanted to point out to you where we're called out in Washington Administrative Code. And you can see that in the Growth Management Act, local jurisdictions are given the responsibility to provide habitat conservation areas. And these are areas where you have endangered, threatened, or sensitive species. And the most important part here is that the WAC calls out, in particular, the Priority Habitats and Species Program, which is our sort of, like, as I said, our flagship program. This is similar to the Shoreline Management Act. Again, local jurisdictions are directed to conserve important resources on the shoreline. And again, it calls out priority habitat species and the Department of Fish and Wildlife as trying to provide that information to those local jurisdictions. And again, it's really important for you to understand, we do this as much as we can as a partnership. Besides this language, we have no regulatory authority, so our effectiveness at conservation is closely related to our effectiveness as being useful partners, understood partners, partners that can communicate without threatening. Just a high-level word about our Priority Habitats and Species Program. That program started in the early 1990s. It has evolved fairly dramatically. We have a presence on the web. We have very many products associated with Priority Habitats and Species. Priority Habitats and Species identifies what species and habitats are priorities for conservation. It helps map where those habitats and species are located. It recommends, through guidance documents, how to protect these species in the context of other land use actions. This is not about fencing off an area and simply walking away. It has to be done in the context of other land use. And importantly, and you've heard this a number of times already, we engage as people in these partnerships. We make ourselves available. We have biologists in the field that work with these local jurisdictions in real time. We're basically in their service. So the authorizing environment, as I've suggested, is through the Growth Management Act and the Shoreline Master Act. And I just wanted to show you a time series photograph of recent growth in Lacey. So you've seen it sort of modeled or simulated across Washington State, and this is what it looks like. So this is from 1990 to 2009. And by the way, all of this growth that's occurring in Lacey is done within the urban growth boundary. The urban growth boundary is the area that's supposed to be targeted for rapid growth. It is also an area that we try to help inform. So when a local jurisdiction is dealing with expanding their urban growth boundary, and George will talk about this in more detail, we come in and we try to say where the best place to expand is that meets their goals and that also protects fish and wildlife and their habitat. Couple more words about the PHS. When it started, it was incredibly simplistic. It basically consisted of dots on maps where we knew the locations of priority species or priority habitats, and we simply handed this out to local jurisdictions and said, please help us protect these areas. Our local guidance was very simple as well, and we said, you know, here's how you protect a site location. As you guys realize, that sort of protection is doomed for failure because sites on maps change. If it's the actual location of an animal, animals don't stay in one place very long. So it was it's a very simplistic approach. Second generation PHS products, of which we consider watershed characterization, includes a much more sophisticated in real-time planning exercise with local jurisdictions. And you can see here, and George will talk about this in detail, but it's actually sitting down and going through scenarios that protect fish and wildlife, but that also meet the user's goals, and that we can modify in real-time as long as we're sitting at the table. All right, with that, I would turn it over to George.
Hello, everyone. So the Watershed Characterization Project is a partnership that goes across programs, wildlife, fish, and habitat. Here are some of the people that have been involved with the project. Myself, Tim, John Jacobson, and Del Gombert, who have been the GIS, the spatial analysts for a lot of the data. Multiple people across the agency have helped us from all three resource programs. And by the way, Paul and Curtis are part of the PISNR program, Puget Sound Nearshore Ecosystem Restoration Project. So in a nutshell, here's what we're trying to do. We're developing core-scale information for local land use planning, and we produce these maps that show the relative habitat conservation value across the Puget Sound Basin. This project right now is constrained to just the Puget Sound Basin. Our goal is to make land use planning by local governments a little smarter. We've had our PHS data and management recommendations out there for decades, and now, as Tim said, we're moving to a landscape scale planning and management recommendations. These fish and wildlife habitat assessments will be complemented by Ecology's water flow and water quality assessments. Ecology and WDFW have been working on this project for about 5 years together. We've had some success with local governments, and because of this success, US EPA has funded this project. Ecology receives funds, they pass through dollars to us, and so a lot of this work has been funded by Ecology. And the Puget Sound Partnership also has taken a great interest in this project because of the success we've had with some local governments in the Puget Sound Basin. So the information we provide to local governments isn't everything they need to know. Some local governments are more progressive. They have their own data, their own knowledge that they can bring to the land use planning process. And so our information, our knowledge, our expertise, combined with local knowledge, including tribal knowledge, is brought to bear on these land use planning problems. So we have five different assessments. We have a marine shoreline habitat assessment, a terrestrial habitat assessment, a freshwater habitat assessment, which focuses on rivers and streams. Ecology does a water quality and a water flow assessment. We can bring these together in different ways to focus on aquatic resources or habitat resources. Or when all five assessments are integrated, we have an overall watershed characterization for the watershed within a local government's jurisdiction. So We're focusing on landscape scale, and this is how local governments, in particular county governments, do landscape scale habitat conservation. It's land use zoning. This is an example from Thurston County. Counties zone all the land under their jurisdiction for various land uses, forestry, agriculture, various residential densities, commercial, and so on. We want to guide this process so that lands that are more appropriate for habitat conservation are kept in a land use that is compatible with that conservation. So, for instance, these green areas in Thurston County are designated as forests of long-term significance. That's really an economic designation. That was his original intent, to keep these industries viable. But they provide a lot of habitat value. The same can be said for the agricultural areas. These are economic designations for the most part, but agricultural lands can provide quite a bit of habitat value. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, so here are the forest areas, and then these brown areas are the areas of long-term significance for agriculture. So as I said, we have three different habitat assessments. I'm going to go over each one. There's terrestrial, freshwater, and marine shorelines. And I'm just going to go over it in a very simple way. It's much more complicated, and we can go into that in more detail if you'd like. But for now, I'll just tell you that the terrestrial index has two components, our priority habitats and species, and then a measure of ecological integrity, which you can think of as a general measure of habitat quality. It's sort of a measure of habitat quality that goes across multiple species. And it's based on habitat fragmentation, the area of habitat that's available, and land use. Those are the main factors that affect ecological integrity. So right to the results. So looking at the entire Puget Sound Basin, which we divided into 2,900 small watershed units. So the modeling you see up there is due to the different small watershed units. Each one has a value from 1 to 19. Those that are in red have a value of 1. They're in the bottom 5% of all of the small watershed units. The ones that are at 19, they're in the top 10% of all these small watershed units in terms of habitat value. And then all the other colors in between are 5% units. So it's really no surprises at this scale. The megalopolis of Tacoma, Seattle, Everett is the lowest habitat value, relatively speaking. The foothills and the mountains of the Cascades and Olympics have the highest habitat value, relatively speaking. So we have this gradient. We have this gradient from the urban areas to the foothills of habitat quality. There are some exceptions, for instance, at the mouths of the major rivers. These areas are important for waterfowl and shorebirds, and so even near urban areas, you can get some dark green colors. So as I said, no surprises here, but when we zoom in, this is where the watershed characterization becomes more useful and informative. So the black areas are urban areas, urban growth areas. The gray are public lands. And so sandwiched between them is what I call the decision space. In the coming decades, city and county governments are going to have to decide where they're going to grow. And watershed characterization can help them decide how to do that. So again, red is the lowest habitat value. Green is the highest habitat value. The other colors are in between. So for instance, in this urban area, this urban growth area, if it were to expand, it would be better to expand into the red, which has lower habitat value, than into these lighter shades of green, which have higher habitat value. And same here. It would be better, from our perspective, that they expand into the red rather than into the green. So this is where watershed characterization is supposed to be used at this scale to make these kinds of decisions. The freshwater index has just three main components. Again, the guts of each of these boxes are pretty complicated, but it has three main components. One is hydrogeomorphic features, which are, it's just a fancy word for wetlands and floodplains. Some audit habitats is a measure of habitat quality and habitat amount for 8 somonid species. So it's a measure of the number of species, the quality of habitat for each of those species, and the amount of habitat for each of those species within each of those 2,900 watershed units. And then a cumulative downstream habitats is the amount of habitat that a place affects downstream. We all know that water flows downhill, not only water, but sediments, pollution, negative impacts, and positive impacts all flow downhill. So a place that impacts a lot of downstream habitat is more important than a place that affects less downstream habitat. So those are the three main components. And here's a map for each. So wetlands and floodplains, no surprises there. Most of your floodplains or wetlands are in the valley bottom. So you can see here's the Skagit. That really stands out as a place with lots of wetlands and floodplains. But it's the same for most of the other major rivers. It's located in the valley bottoms. Accumulative downstream habitat is effectively the photographic negative of wetlands and floodplains. Wetlands and floodplains are located in the bottoms of the valleys. The places that impact the most habitat are located in the headwaters, near the tops of the valleys. So they're just about the negatives. And then here we can have local surmounted habitat values can be high just about anywhere. Because even though most species are located in the valley bottoms, that's where the highest species richness is. You can have high quality steelhead or cutthroat habitat even in headwaters. So it's more diffuse. Now we can bring these three components in a number of ways. I'm going to show you two of them. One way is just to add them all up. So in the previous slide, the scores ranged from 0 to 10. 0 being a red, actually gray. 0 is gray, number 1 is red, and 10 being dark green. So each of these range from 0 to 10. We just add them up, now our scores go from 1 to 30. Again, not a lot of surprise that the urban areas have the lowest value. Green, shades of green, have the highest value. And you can see they're kind of distributed in a lot of different places. And this allows city and county governments to decide where to grow and do it in a way that has the least impact to fish habitats. Now go back to this slide. Now notice there's places that are green on this slide and places that are green on this slide and places that are green on this slide. So if it's green here, it means it's important for wetlands. If it's green here, it's important for the protection of downstream habitats. If it's green here, it's important because it has lots of high-quality salmon habitat within it. Now, what if we bring all the green together to show all the places that are important for at least one of these things? Well, that's the distribution of scores. Well, if we do that, if we show you all the places that are important for at least one of those three things, a lot of Puget Sound Basin, most of it, is important for at least one of those three things. So while this slide gives county governments some flexibility, because you can see there are differences in the scores, this slide could be kind of scary for people trying to plan future growth in a way that does minimal impact to salmon habitats. I think we can do it. We can figure that out. But we're going to have to be careful because there are a lot of places that have impacts on salmon habitats. Again, here's the distribution. You can see that there are a lot of places that score high for at least one of those three components. So the last assessment is the marine shorelines assessment. Unlike the other two environments, the terrestrial environment and the freshwater environment, we have a lot of data in the marine environment. And one reason for that is in the marine environment, there are a lot of things that we like to eat, and we keep careful watch over the things that we like to eat. So shellfish, salmon, things like that. And then the habitats that support those things that we like to eat, like eelgrass and kelp, and the forage fish that they feed upon. We have to keep track of all those things because we like to eat them. So we have lots of data, and we give this data to local governments. So the question is, how is a local land use planner who doesn't have the expertise in marine biology or in wildlife habitat, how are they supposed to make sense of all this data? Well, that's where we come in. That's what watershed characterization does. It makes sense of all these data that they have, but they really don't know what to do with. So the approach we took for the Marine Shorelines Index is we said, let's just add up all the stuff that is located along each shoreline. So we broke the shoreline in the Puget Sound Basin into approximately 10,000 units, and they ranged anywhere from 1/10 of a mile to several miles, averaged about 1/4 mile. And for each of the shoreline units, we attached to it in the database all the species, habitat, species groups that were in its proximity for which we had data. And we had data for about 41 species groups or habitat types. So now every shoreline unit on our database has attached to it what's closest to it, what's in its vicinity. So if you do that, and you just add up all the different things that are on the shoreline, all 41 things, you get a map that looks like this. So again, 0.95 to 1 are the highest scores. The lowest scores, if it's a 0, it has this bright blue. And I'll talk about that in a moment. And then these shades of red to green give you the different levels of stuff that are there. A lot of stuff if you're green, very little stuff if you're red. And here's the distribution of scores. You can see there's a few number of these segments that have a lot of stuff. And there's a lot in the middle that have kind of a moderate amount of stuff. And then there's just a small number that have a little amount of stuff. And there's every shoreline segment has something. There are no shoreline segments that are this bright color of blue. Every shoreline segment has something. And the absolute winners are the deltas, which is not a surprise. The mouths of the major rivers are the greenest because they have the most species groups or habitat types. But again, I want to emphasize that just about every shoreline segment has some species or habitats. Now, this is really sort of a measure of quantity. So if we take a look at a measure of quality, we have something like this. So it shows that just about every shoreline segment has high quality of something, a species group, a habitat type. There's a lot more green in this map than in this map. Everything has something, and there's also a lot of places that have high quality for something. Again, you can see the shift in the distribution. A lot of places with a moderate amount of stuff. Now we have a lot of places that have high quality for at least something. And I think this has big implications for the Shoreline Management Act, which says that there can be no net loss of ecological function along marine shorelines. So local governments have to deal with this. Habitat is a function. And every place there's a species, there's a habitat. And so to follow the Shoreline Management Act and have no net loss of ecological function, it's going to be quite a challenge. So here's the next to last slide. So remember this. We have three separate habitat assessments, plus we have two assessments from ecology. We're working very closely with ecology. These are core scale assessments for core scale planning, such as land use zoning. Zoning also occurs under the Shoreline Management Act. We have multiple results that provide a robust perspective. That is, if all five assessments point to the same place as important, you can be more confident that that really is an important place, and we should invest effort and money to protect that place. If there's only one assessment pointing to that, to a particular place as important, then we have to think a little bit harder about how important it really is and look more deeply into the data, into our analysis, to make sure there's no error. And ultimately, there are no easy answers. We have to integrate this information that I've shown you today with other information, such as the assessments done by PSNRP, the Puget Sound Nearshore Ecosystem Restoration Project, assessments done by other groups, other agencies, to come up with the best answers for smarter growth in the Puget Sound Basin. And that's all we have to say today. Any questions?
Really good presentation. Really interesting. Commissioner Jennings?
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, going back to the early part of the presentation about working with local governments, I did have a chance to work on the Thurston County's working group for a critical area ordinance on wildlife issues back when they were adopting it, and the department was there at every meeting providing a lot of good information and technical support. So you're right on target about how local governments really need this department's expertise, and you guys were there. So good work. Second, one of the things I heard you saying, but you didn't use this phrase, is protect the best of what's left. And this tool is a nice way to help identify the best of what's left. When you talked about a core scale, and you might have said it, but I didn't really hear it, what level of scale is that? And I'm just coming from looking at your Thurston County examples. I live in the Green Cove Creek watershed, which is one of the highest quality watersheds left in Thurston County because of, from a salmonid species perspective. And yet I looked at a lot of these maps, and they were like yellow and kind of red. And so what is a coarse scale in this context?
Well, we're trying to match the scale of our assessment. We want to match the scale of the decisions that are being made. And local land use zoning done by county governments is typically on the order of hundreds to thousands of acres. So when they make a decision, they're changing a zoning designation over, you know, hundreds of acres to something else. And so that's about the scale that we're aiming for.
And I would just add that we do have other tools for dealing with smaller spatial scales. So if we've got a customer that says, you know, I want to plan Green Cove-sized area, we call it local habitat assessment, which is then one step down from the watershed characterization. And just so you know, it's you absolutely need to be able to plan at multiple spatial scales. You can't stop at one scale because it doesn't answer the questions. You always have to start and work from very fine scale to coarser scale.
Commissioner Smith.
In the world of interagency turf, how would you characterize our relationship with Puget Sound Partnership?
So I actually sit on the science panel of the Puget Sound Partnership, and I would say that relationships with DNR and DOE, we're in a state of an evolving relationship. We're on our third date, our fourth date. We're learning how to help each other, to be synergistic rather than to be duplicative. There are challenges. Clearly, there are challenges, but they have, in this instance, they have fully supported watershed characterization. In fact, they were the ones that said to EPA that this is a tool that we need for the terrestrial piece. Because the terrestrial piece was really sort of under the radar for the Puget Sound Partnership when they first started. I can also say that the department was one of the main drivers for making sure that the Puget Sound Partnership looked at the ecosystem as a whole, from the top of the mountains, through the entire basins, through the water, through the marine environment.
Director Anderson, do you want to add something?
Well, I don't know how many dates we've been on, for sure. But I think as the partnership has evolved and has had different leadership, they have put a lot of focus on planning. And we have had several different iterations of the action agenda and strategic priority discussions. And as we've been doing that, the clock's been ticking toward 2020, which is an important date in terms of the objectives that were set forth by the legislature for the partnership in terms of Puget Sound recovery. And I think I would say that we are a bit frustrated by the amount of work that's been put into planning and creating documents as opposed to going out and doing work that has benefits and measurable benefits. And so we've worked closely with the partnership, and as Tim said, he's been an integral part of the, he was the chair of the science team for, I don't know how long, but
a year.
And so we're working, and of course they're going to be undergoing another change in leadership with Tony Wright leaving, and the new director hasn't been appointed yet by Governor Inslee. So while we've been doing our best to work with them and contribute to the recovery of Puget Sound, I would say within the last year and a half, we have gone on about our work in terms of trying to do work that's that has measurable benefits in terms of recovery and are less willing to spend as much time in the planning efforts that the partnership has led and been focused on. And so we're hoping I don't want to speak for Department of Natural Resources or Ecology, but I think we've been working very close with them in terms of the work that we're doing, and I think they've taken a similar maybe change of direction that we have. So we're anxious to have the new director appointed, Commissioner Goldmark and myself and Ted Sturdivant, when he was director of ecology, had a number of different conversations with the partnership's leadership over the course of the last couple of years, trying to get us to a point where we were moving forward and doing the work that needed to be done rather than spending all of our time planning for the work that needed to be done.
Commissioner Perry.
Thank you. You mentioned your main focus is working with governments at various levels in terms of zoning and so forth and growth management. What about work with private entities that maybe have a substantial impact on a given area? Do you try to supply this information to them and guide their growth if that's occurring?
We do. As a matter of fact, just recently we were working with the Skagit Land Trust. And we provided this information to them, and we worked with them on how they could use it to their advantage. And so we actually have a technical team comprised of scientists from ecology and Department of Fish and Wildlife, and we help local governments. That's our emphasis. But local NGOs, if they need assistance, and we have the resources at the time, because governments are our emphasis, but if we have the resources and the time, then we do help them as well.
Continuing on with that, Department of Fish and Wildlife purchases property on a fairly regular basis. Almost every meeting we have land purchases come up. Does your work integrate into that process?
It has not been. Up to now, it has not been integrated into that.
Seems to me like that would be a natural to determine where... particularly outside of the, most of our land purchases seem to be in eastern Washington, and your focus, at least your presentation, was on the Puget Sound area. Are you intending to expand into eastern Washington with the same sort of analysis?
We'd like to, but at present we don't have funding to do that. And as I said, it's a partnership with Ecology that's partially funded through US EPA. And right now the EPA is focusing on Puget Sound. So if we can get funding from some other source, we would, but we don't have plans to do that right now.
Thank you.
Okay, Commissioner Jennings.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just following up along the point that Chuck raised, working with the private sector. At Health, we have a program where we've identified where water is in the environment that will be a future drinking water supply. And well, a protection program. And we publish those maps. And what we've found is that the private sector uses them when they look at siting decisions. So, and that's a very easy one, but, you know, ARCO is going to put in 4 more gas stations somewhere in these 3 counties. If they can say, well, you know, of the 10 possible sites we've identified, 4 are within the 2-year time of travel for a public drinking water supply, well, it says that if they try and pick that site, it's going to be very expensive from a local government's concern about what their activities are that will not contaminate drinking water. So even though they're not directly talking to us about it, the fact that we post that information up on our website allows them to incorporate it into their decision-making process. So I would just ask, is this data available on the web for people to look at so that, in fact, even if they didn't contact us directly, they might be able to look at that and say, these 2 watersheds, we're going to probably have less blowback if we try and propose some sort of a large development in, you know, watershed A versus watershed B?
It is available. And Ecology is developing a watershed characterization website that will house these data and allow anyone to download them. And also on that website are some case studies and some other information about the best ways to use this information. That new website, the watershed characterization website, won't be up for a few months yet. It's already on the web, but this fancier site will be up in a few months.
Okay. I have a couple things that I wanted to talk with you about. You've already answered one of my questions, which is, why is this not being applied to the coast, which is really the site of the last best places, if you're talking about salmonid habitat? And you've already explained that it's a funding issue. EPA is putting a priority on Puget Sound. Do you think there's any chance that EPA and others may be more influenced by the larger argument that Puget Sound is not the last best place for salmonids, but it's actually the Olympic Peninsula and the coastal estuaries? We talk about this constantly on the coast because the lion's share of the restoration funding goes to Puget Sound. Some people refer to it as a basket case in which you can just pour millions, tens of millions of dollars with little benefit, whereas if you took just a fraction of that money and put it out on the coast, you'd be getting a lot more bang for the buck. So is that kind of thinking ever going to be given some serious consideration by the funding sources?
You'd have to ask them.
But I'll give you more than that. We do have other processes in place at the Department of Fish and Wildlife that try to deal with areas outside of the watershed characterization area, which is Puget Sound. They tend to be a little bit more fragmented because, as you noticed here, we tried to get water quality and water quantity or flow issues associated with lentic and lotic environments in the terrestrial environment and the marine nearshore environment. So this was a push to really try to get everything in one place that would make it accessible and easier to understand and use. You know, we get a lot of complaints about getting fragmented information. And perhaps in the Puget Sound, that criticism holds strongest. But we do have other planning exercises that we're doing. PHS is a statewide program, and we've got some things that we're trying in PHS outside of the Puget Sound Basin.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I had to say that because you're obviously doing good work in Puget Sound, but it's not extending out to some of the most important salmon habitat areas. The other thing is, have you guys looked into intrinsic potential modeling, IP modeling?
It's included in this. We have used intrinsic potential models.
Okay.
I was just going to say, one of the things that we're very sensitive to is making sure that the science that goes behind this meets the highest standards of science as indicated by, we do extensive peer review. We had university experts from around the region help us in the formative stages of how to put together these indexes, and then we gave them a free shot to tell us what they liked and didn't like, and we responded to all those in a very formal process. So we would say this meets the highest standards of best available science right now, and it was our goal to do that from the very start.
Just to fill in some details, we had 8 salmonid species, and right now there are only 3 intrinsic potential models available for 3 species, coho, steelhead, and chinook. There's a chum model on the way, but it wasn't available in time for this assessment. Mm-hmm. So as other intrinsic potential models become available, if we have the time, we can incorporate them into this assessment.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Great. Thanks. Any other questions, comments? Good job.
Thank you.
Good job. Thanks. Very interesting. Thanks.